Welcome to Prefer Not To, a weekly cocktail hour with your hosts, me, Josh, and
me,
Tate. Where we talk about culture and all other sorts of things while enjoying a fresh cocktail of our own making. So, Kate, what's our cocktail this week?
This week, per suggestion of a listener, we are doing a sidecar.
And tell me about the sidecar.
The sidecar is a early 20th century cocktail that became particularly famous around World War I in either London or Paris, depending on who you believe. It is made up of a particular type of bourbon or cognac, whatever you want to do, some kind of orange liqueur, such as Cointreau or Triple Sec, and some fresh squeezed lemon, and then you rim the glass in sugar, and chill, and shake, and everything's dandy.
This sounds remarkably similar, at least in tang-to-sweet ratio, to our gimlet cast.
Oh, I thought you were going to say a margarita. People have actually called it a brandy margarita.
Oh, because of the triple sec.
And the sweet and sweetness. The rim and everything like that, yeah. Again, no one really knows how it came across. One of the more fanciful ones idea is that it was developed in a Parisian bistro during World War I by friend of a course, who rode to said bar in a sidecar of a motorcycle, and that's where the sidecar comes from.
Did he enjoy the beverage in the sidecar?
I think maybe he enjoyed it so much that he stumbled into the sidecar, meaning to get into the motorcycle. I don't know.
Fair enough. Yes. Better than operating the motor vehicle itself. So what time were we talking about? You said World War I.
That would have been World War I. Most early 20s popular books about cocktails and collections of cocktails mention the sidecar, and everybody either says that it happened in London or in Paris. Often at the Ritz in either location by the bartender or friend of the bartender.
You know, back then that was the kitchen wars between the Savoy and the Ritz were huge back around the turn of the century. So I imagine any cocktail you could have that would promote your particular venue, you would probably want to capitalize on. So have you had it yet?
I haven't. I just wanted to point out that if that sounds vague when it comes to history, it's probably because most cocktails have vague histories and everybody disputes how they're made, why they're made, and who originally made them.
This is something that we're discovering as we go along, that there are a lot of people who take credit for the creation of a successful cocktail.
Well, to be fair, people probably tweak it as it goes along, so they all feel like it.
That's true. Well, let's go ahead and have a taste.
Oh, wow.
That is nummy.
That is a tasty treat.
It is a tasty treat.
I see why the margarita of the sugar.
You're already losing coherence.
The sugar and the salt and the tanginess and the bitter, it's...
Look at you, you're getting flush.
Anyway, the sidecar is actually very tasty.
Yeah,
see,
I like
the margarita to brandy thing as being very true.
This is our first brandy drink.
No. That was bourbon. The Rob Roy was bourbon.
Right.
Ah. All right.
No. So I feel a little bit like Winston Churchill.
Winston Churchill was a drinker of martinis.
And of brandy.
And of brandy. Speaking of brandy, do you know what type of brandy this is?
It's a Palmasson brandy, I believe. Which I think is going to dovetail into our next topic. Is that correct, Kate?
Yes, but I wanted to point out to anybody listening that it was $2 more expensive than the next brandy next to it. However, you gotta pay for the name sometimes. That's what you're paying for.
Well, if you were paying for the name, you would have gotten, you know, Courvoisier or something. Or
actually, one of the recipes I looked at told me to use Hennessy.
Well, there you go.
Nope. No one's got time for that.
Anyhow, the discussion of Palmasson leads us into the debut of our first recurring feature, which we're going to call Explain It To Me, in which one or the other of us asks the other one to explain something that he or she doesn't understand. And Kate and I, being of different generations but similar temperaments, have a large body of things that we are not aware of that we can ask the other one to explain to us.
I will say that it's a little difficult because we do tend to agree on a lot of different things.
That's true. But
random things, but we're pretty much even across the board.
So this week, Kate, what was it that you wanted me to explain the broad appeal that it has to me, to you?
Orson Welles.
That's right. Kate has asked me to explain why I like Orson Welles, which is the link to Palmasson is, of course, Orson Welles did a famous series of commercials in the late 70s and early 80s for Palmasson wine, which featured the signature catchphrase, "We will sell no wine before it's time." By this point in his career, Orson Welles had sort of become
a caricature.
Right. A Falstaffian character, someone he had played a lot in his youth. Here's the appeal of Orson Welles. He's a guy who reached huge success very early in life. When he was 21, he did the production of Julius Caesar. I think it was 21, and then he did Citizen Kane at 25, followed that up with Magnificent Ambersons very shortly after, had great success on the stage and on the screen, very young, a master of both the craft of acting, the craft of filmmaking, the craft of writing, and a generally very clever man. He, even late in life, very generous and funny and, like I said, Falstaffian. Which, by the way, was one of his favorite characters, and he spent a large portion of his own money and a lot of time creating a composite movie of Falstaff as a character through his several plays. He called it Falstaff. It got released as the name Chimes at Midnight. It's hard to find on DVD, but if you can, I highly recommend it. It's a lot of people think that it's his best work, and that's a body of work that includes Citizen Kane and The Magnificent Ambersons. So it is only for want of having been seen that people do not regard it more than they do. So the appeal of him is just that he was such a master, so young, and such a charismatic personality. And then to have him be brought down to a level that we recognize, a very human level of scrounging for his next buck, staying at friends' houses, doing commercials. I think we've seen, you've mentioned the commercials where he's, the outtakes from the Palmasan commercials where he's clearly way more than two sheets to the wind doing them. There's another one, I believe, where he's doing commercial for peas that he's...
Oh, yeah.
And in fact, spent the last 20 years of his life or 15 years of his life trying to make another movie that supposedly is very nearly done with, you know, Peter Bogdanovich and John Huston was the star, you know, another titan of the cinema, but never got completed before his death because he was scrounging money and he filmed it over the course of years. And every time he got enough money, he would put it right into making this picture. The appeal is just someone so dedicated to his craft and so excited about it and yet still ending his life on a somewhat downbeat note.
So you're saying that he peaked early?
Well, he's sort of the quintessential peak early, but the fact that he kept at it.
What you're saying to me is that Orson Welles is the captain of the high school football team who didn't get a scholarship to college and then spends the rest of his life yelling at Little League.
No. Orson Welles, no. Orson Welles is the guy who invented a new sport, became the captain of his own team, won the world championship of it, and then wanted to do something else.
Okay.
He was the best film director of his time. He was a great writer. And a huge personality, additionally. So that is the appeal of Orson Welles. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the first edition of what we hope to be a regular recurring feature, Explain It to Me. Did you have something else you wanted to ask me about Orson Welles?
No, I was going to point out that you do tend to have a thing for vastly talented people who fall off in the middle of their career.
That is true.
Eddie Murphy.
Right.
Elvis.
I like, and keep trying at it. You know, I like, you know, who was it? Was it Lionel Trilling or whoever said there's no second acts in America, that's just completely untrue. We love second acts. We love third acts. We love fifth acts.
Looking at you, John Travolta.
Right. I mean, who would have thought in 1989, 90, when he was making movies that nobody saw, you know, Look Who's Talking For, that, you know, for at least a brief period, he would be well-regarded again. He's sort of not now, but, you know, for a brief period, would be well-regarded again. So if you have suggestions, by the way, of things that if you have heard Kate or I mention on a show and you do not understand our enthusiasms for him and would like to devote a segment of Explain It to Me to you, I encourage you to do so. I wish you guys could have been on the air earlier when Kate called me the master.
I did no such thing.
That could be an explain it to me, why I like the master, Paul Thomas Anderson.
That actually is something I'd be very interested in.
Have you seen it yet?
No.
You need to see it first. It's brilliant. It was the best movie that came out last year, at least that I saw, by a large margin.
Some friends of mine described it to me as two-thirds of a movie.
They're wrong.
Well, maybe they can write in and ask you to explain the master.
Were these your lost friends?
Yes.
Well, there you go. That would be lucky to be two-thirds of a TV show.
It really is only two-thirds of a TV show.
That's very true.
Have we discussed this in depth, the Lost thing?
Yet? I think we have like six listeners, and we've already had one who said he won't listen if we start talking about Lost.
Only if we deride Rob. Dry brush.
Which we're going to do if we talk about
Lost. Yeah, you're
right.
Gotta just leave it.
Suffice it to say that neither Kate nor I find Lost a entertaining program. So have at us, internet. It's part of the whole, you know, fanboy culture that sort of grates. I think it grates a little at you, too. As, you know, you like 19th century literature and other things that aren't necessarily terribly in vogue lately. It's like, well, this is what we were talking about, reboots the other day. And how, again, a term that I think pretty much comes out of the fanboy nerd culture. As it's a computer term that got applied to storytelling.
I never really thought of it before, but you're right.
And it's a term that was not in vogue when I was a kid. I think it's purely come about since the great age of comic book movies. I don't ever recall hearing about a reboot. I mean, obviously because personal computers were not terribly popular pre-1985 or whatever. I don't know. It bothers me. The term bothers me because just, you know, come up with a new way to say it. That word's taken.
Reimagining.
Right. Retelling. You know, and second of all, I think it stems from a certain element of fan culture that is either wildly laudatory of something or insanely condemnatory, and there is no middle ground, and there is no realm for subjectivity. To wit, Superman Returns.
Oh, yeah.
A movie that I thoroughly enjoyed.
I did too.
And we'll tell everyone that I thoroughly enjoyed. But
come at me, internet.
But because fanboys just yelled and moaned, and comic book people. And by the way, this is the problem with having movies made on comic books. But just that so much of our storytelling has been bound up in things that are derived from this genre.
The thing about comic books that bothers me when they're translated to screen is that often it's taken from a series of years and years and years and volumes of characters and events. When you make a Spider-Man movie, you can make it a score of different villains, but someone's going to be mad that you chose the Green Goblin over Doctor Doom.
The problem, and I think you've touched on it exactly, is that the problem is that people come to these movies expecting a sort of checklist of things. Like, if I'm going to go see a Spider-Man reboot, I'm going to see Uncle Ben, I'm going to see the damn radioactive spider. It ties the hands of storytelling, so that storytelling becomes a secondary objective to meeting this checklist, which I think is what you see, which is one of the reasons that I liked Superman Returns so much, that it was not a reboot. It was a sort of left-handed continuation of the old Christopher Reeve continuity. You know, it's conveniently ignored that the previous two Superman movies hadn't happened, but other than that, and it didn't try to reinvent, you know, we didn't have Jor-El, we didn't have the little baby craft, we didn't have him building the Fortress of Solitude, and I think that's good.
No, there's a part of Superman Returns where I'm pretty sure they took Marlon Brando's voiceover in the original one and incorporated it.
Right, but that was when he went back to the Fortress of Solitude. They took footage that was not used.
Right, in the original.
Right, but I'm saying they didn't cover the same ground that they had covered. They were telling an entirely new story. And that's part of my problem with the reboot is, especially when you it's my problem with the comic book movies in general, that people are expecting this checklist of shit from another medium. But B, if you're doing a reboot, you know, it ties the hands. I mean, also, it makes it easier for shitty filmmakers because, like, okay, we can take up 45 minutes with, you know, Bruce Wayne's parents getting killed and...
I'm going to have to defend the internet on this. The Dark Knight series, reimagining, reboot, whatever, very good. However, oh gosh, the internet's going to hate us if they listen to this. Josh and I went to go see The Dark Knight Rises together, and we both left together and got in the car and were thinking, my God, wasn't that awful?
Well, you know, here's an interesting thing, though. I think opinion has actually moved around on that. I think there are a lot of people who have come back around to our way of thinking, not necessarily as strenuously against that movie as you and I were almost immediately, but enough so that it's not. There are plenty of people who criticize that movie now. But when it first came out, because reaction was so dominated by the binary fandom culture of I either like it or I hate it, and if I like it, it's the best thing ever, it skewed perception. You know what it's like? It's like Les Mis. When Les Mis came out, now this isn't nerd fandom culture, this is just musicals, there was a lot of people who were crazy about it the weekend it came out, right now, I think critical opinion is mediocre to negative on that movie, wouldn't you say?
I haven't really kept up with it.
My point being just initial responses of non-critical sources have become magnified in the internet age. So the voices of people who are the most enthusiastic about it, this is something that we've talked about before. It's it's a, you know, it's a cultural version of the Fox News phenomenon. You know, where, and they're very much like that, the way that, you know, fandom folks will, critics who disagree with them, who dislike movies, will just get scores and scores of comments about how they're idiots because they disagree, because their taste differs. I mean, I find it tiresome.
I think also part of it is the classic, I liked this band, but then they got too popular idea. You know, like if you're a really big fan of a local band, they eventually become bigger and bigger. Or if you're even a fan of an indie underground band and then they get a song on the radio and everyone jumps on it.
Yeah, but the bandwagon phenomenon is, I think...
No, what I'm saying is that if you are the original nerd or fan and then all of a sudden things get really popular, you get angry.
I can see that being a factor in it, especially because a lot of nerds sort of feel like this is theirs. And I understand that, because I grew up that way. I mean, when X-Men movies, I'm still very protective of that canon, because that was when I was a teenager, you know, and felt on the outside, and, like, I didn't have any friends. I long, you know, every kid in the mid-80s who was reading those Claremont and Byrne X-Men stories were just going home every night hoping that they would wake up in the morning and be able to shoot mind bullets at somebody.
Oh, I named my cat Beast after Beast.
Well, there you go. So my point is, I understand the affection.
I do too. It's part of the reason, and this is going to sound petty, but I'm not the biggest J.J. Abrams fan. So when I found out he was directing Star Trek, the reboot,
mm-hmm.
I was very incredibly angry. More so angry when it came out and everybody loved it. And yes, it is a good movie. But I'm somebody who watches old Star Trek episodes at 3 in the morning. And have for a long time.
Let me ask you, how did you like how they handled integrating that into the continuity?
I was waiting to see the sequel.
Mm-hmm.
And when the sequel came out, listeners, I'm very poor. I cannot spend money on movie tickets, particularly ones that profit J.J. Abrams in his career.
Wow, you are really, really going at Abrams.
He's just,
By the way, I do not share your opinion of J.J. I think he is a talented and good guy who has notable flaws.
See, this is how bad my distaste for Lost has, it's poisoned me to the point where anybody associated with Lost, just, no. When Desmond, the character from Lost, showed up on Scandal, not as Desmond, but as a different guy, I was like, can he please be written off the show? And then he was, and it was wonderful.
Still didn't get you to stop watching Scandal.
That's my point, is that it's a great show, but the fact that Desmond was on it, all I could see when he was on screen talking to the other actors was him running around screaming about Penne's boat, you know? And
so your beef with J.J. Abrams is...
Lost.
Okay, so it's just Lost. So it's... But hold on. Let me... I'm going to probe a little bit on this, okay?
Sorry, I just wanted to point out, I also do not care for...
Felicity? Alias?
No, those are fine.
Mission Impossible 3?
Cloverfield! Did not care for Cloverfield.
Oh, yeah. No, I think he does some things really well and some things...
It's the point where now he has been so accepted by mainstream America and the mainstream nerd culture,
mm-hmm.
so to speak, which is basically America, but it's everybody who fancies themselves a nerd now that nerd is cool.
I don't care about that. I think if you, you know...
He can't do anything wrong. That's the problem.
You know, that's not his fault, though. You know,
except he does do things wrong, and his movies aren't that great, and they're actually kind of predictable to a certain point.
Well, but that's fine. That's a fair criticism. But I think your criticism, you are being unfair to him because of the cultural context that he is in and not because of the work that he does. You know, I can understand a visceral dislike of someone because of other people's visceral instant approbation of anything that they do. You know, I can understand that. I can understand people being irritatingly excited about J.J. Abrams doing anything.
That's what I'm saying.
Right. But I don't think it's fair to hold it against the guy. I think you hold it against nerd culture.
I don't hold it against the guy. You know, harkening back to a couple of podcasts, if I passed J.J. in the dairy aisle, I'd be like, you know what, this lactose-free yogurt It's super good. You should try it. 10 yogurts for $10. I would not speak to the guy. He did revive the Star Trek fan franchise, which is something that I appreciate and enjoy, just because it gives me an excuse to see Zachary Quinto in tight pants on screen. But ultimately, it's what you said. It's the culture that has raised him up as a god. It's why Doctor Who is so annoying.
It's the binary nature of nerd culture. So there's a new restaurant in town that I like a great deal, that I enjoy eating at a great deal. It's and they have fresh vein food, and they have, it's, you know, very, our town is very progressive, and they have lots of gluten-free, vegan, da-da-da-da stuff. But it's also very well-sourced, locally sourced, and well-made stuff. However, I was there the other day, and while I know how to, I am somewhat occasionally less than 100% confident about the pronunciation of certain foods. You know, have you ever had this problem? And I will see a food that I know I am going to enjoy. And I'll give you an example. Udon noodles. Didn't know how to pronounce udon noodles.
That's how I am with Thai food.
Right. So I didn't know how to... And you know, I love Asian-wide noodles that I enjoy very much. You know, I love pad see and would eat them.
No. That's me. Is, you know, there is a Thai place that I was introduced to by a friend of mine from college and continued to frequent with boyfriends and such like that, and it's delicious. But the first time I went in there, the only thing, and this says a lot about me, the only thing I knew how to pronounce was pad Thai. And
I think that's like the gringo dish of choice at a Thai restaurant.
It is, and I admit that, but, you know, there was a lot of other things that looked delicious, like with duck and stewed all the things, and particularly pad see ew, they had a pronunciation next to the name on the menu, probably because I'm guessing the waitstaff just kept getting pissed off. It's like why Mexican restaurants have a description of the dish. What is a burrito? A burrito is, like, have you seen that?
Yeah, you know, at this point, though, I don't even think, if you don't know what a burrito is, you don't deserve to be spending money in public.
Have you been to a Mexican restaurant that has, like, a glossary of terms on the back?
Yeah, I have. Whatever. By the way, I've noticed this. Speaking of, you mentioned Mexican restaurants. They don't put arroz con pollo on the menu anymore. They call it ACP. Have you noticed that?
No.
It says ACP. It doesn't say arroz con pollo.
Why?
Because I think people can't say arroz con pollo.
Oh, okay. That would be why they have the pronunciation next to things like chilaquiles. Sounds like
I love chilaquiles. Have I ever made for you my chilaquiles?
No.
Oh, they're really good. You know what chilaquiles are good for? The day after Thanksgiving, we have all of that, the really bad meat left on the bird. You shred it off the bird, and you get leftover tortillas or corn chips and, like, some salsa verde, and you make it in the pan, and you make some chilaquiles.
Wait, you keep all the meat on the bird until you're ready to eat it the next day?
No. I'm just saying, like, the stuff, the little bits that are not, like, huge steaks. Like, the dark stuff from the bottom and the...
But you don't keep a bird carcass in your fridge.
No, I dispose of a carcass. Okay. I mean, it might be, you know, a few hours, but my point being, it is a good use for otherwise non-sandwichable second-day Thanksgiving meat. It's chilaquiles.
Oh, well, I wouldn't know, but what I was going for was that when they make you pronounce it like a burrito, they like put it in there like chimichanga, and it sounds to me like the ice cream commercial for like stracciatella.
You were doing that just because you knew it irritates me when it comes on Hulu Plus.
Stracciatella. Please tell me other people have heard of this.
Yeah, there's these ads where they have lips. It's like the big, it's like Clutch Cargo lips, but they're pronouncing like limoncello.
It's Haagen-Dazs gelato flavors. Cappuccino. And they all sound like they're having an orgasm, which is just very problematic to begin with.
Well, it tells you how effective the ad is that I can't for the life of me remember what the fuck it is that they're selling. So
Haagen-Dazs gelato. brand ice cream.
My point is just that I have been cowed by not being able to pronounce something into not ordering things at restaurants that look good. I think a lot of people, for instance, have problem with quinoa.
I did not until, because before I even knew what quinoa was, I had a roommate who was like, oh, I'm making this with quinoa instead of rice. And I was like, say what now? So that's when I figured it out.
Well, then there's the opposite. There's the other realm of words that you have only read and never heard pronounced.
Oh, don't get me started on that. I'm a nanny, and my kids have started recently reading out loud. And today we were reading a story, and it involved an aquarium.
Sure.
And it just made me think about all the things that you pronounce in your head that are differently than how they're pronounced out loud. Like, hirsute?
That's correct. How did you think it was pronounced?
Hirsute. I don't know why.
I have no idea why.
And to this day, I still mispronounce oregano. I had to just think about pronouncing that. I have to think about pronouncing oregano because of a Simpsons episode that told me how to pronounce it before the word I ever heard it or read the word myself.
Here's the one that always gets me, and you know this, but I did not, and I had heard, this is the embarrassing part. I had seen the word in print, and I had heard it said, and had never connected the two words as being the same word.
Really?
And that word is lingerie. In my head, there was the sexy thing, lingerie, and then there was the section at Belk Leggett called lingerie.
See, whenever, for me, whenever I'm giving a recipe, if I'm reading it to someone, and if it calls for oregano, I always, my first instinct is to say, okay, so you're going to need a bit of a dash of oregano.
Well, yeah, it's better than Idaho-o.
And it's simply because of a Simpsons episode that I saw when apparently I was way too young to know what oregano was.
My point being, you know, I think servers and cooks should be cognizant of the fact that there are some less cool people in the world who may, in fact, not know how to pronounce quinoa.
Well, even in my line of business, there's a bunch of parents who are confused calling for top items. They have no idea, like, they just know their kid wants this thing, and they think it's called, like, a Nintendar, and then, you know, you're like, oh, it's a Nintendo, you know? Like,
yeah, well, that cuts to the issue of customer service in the place where, in the town where we live, let me put it this way, it's a very politically progressive community, but it's also very affluent. And oftentimes, I have found, and I think Kate will agree, that the affluent behavior trumps the progressive behavior, especially when dealing with customer service types in stores or restaurants. Do you think that's accurate, being one of those people?
It's difficult to say. I think people who are affluent, who feel inclined to customer service people, do it when it suits them. If they go to the thrift shop that donates half of its profits towards, you know, starving children in Africa, they're a lot more gracious about the fact that they don't have a size 12 in this particular flat.
Right.
If it's a standard, but if it's something going to a coffee shop, one of those classic luxuries that our town, or a beauty salon, or something like that, they...
I'll tell you a story, and we'll get back to Macklemore, because I know you want to get to that.
I'm biased, but I would agree with you, yes.
I'll tell you a story, and I'm not going to name names on anyone, but a person that I know was involved in a retail service, I guess it was service, not retail, a job, and it was her first day on the job. And someone that she knew, a previous neighbor, came into the establishment and asked for assistance from her. And when she fumbled a little bit because it was her first day or wasn't able to immediately provide her with the information she needed, she asked to see a manager in the sort of demanding tone that we associate with people who are accustomed to giving a demanding tone.
As a side note, if you are a manager and someone is displeased with you and says, I'd like to see a manager, and you say, I am the manager, it is so fulfilling.
That's true. When I was a newspaper editor, it was the same thing when people wanted to talk to the editor. My point being, she asked to speak to the manager. The manager came out, and then she said this of my friend when the guy said, you'll have to forgive us, this is her first day, she's just learning the ropes. The patron said, she should wear a sticker on her shirt that says, I'm a learner. And I could not think of anything more designed to reify a perceived status difference than the request of the affluent customer of the minimum wage first day employee that she wear a sticker telling the world exactly what her status was. And that's the kind of thing that you see in our nominally progressive community.
I want to comment on this, I really do, but I feel like it would just open up this firestorm that would eventually lead to me getting fired for bad talking the clientele.
I can respect your choice. Although I don't think they're going to fire you because that business runs on your blood, sweat, and tears.
Suffice it to say that I have dealt with customers that are so nasty they make me cry.
Yeah, I think people don't understand that. I think that there are a lot of people who, because they have contempt for people who work in retail or service, they think that the people who do those jobs have contempt for the jobs, and they don't consider that when you say something like that to someone, that it actually hurts.
Yeah.
You know, they think that, you know, for whatever reason that, you know, I would never do that job unless I was hard on my luck, so that person must be hard on their luck. Not that person is doing something that they enjoy or that fits their hours or that is with people that they enjoy working with. And when you criticize unnecessarily their work, it's hurtful. I think legitimately it's because of their contempt for the job that they conflate that with contempt for the person.
I'm a little give and take on that, but I'm inclined to agree.
Let me tell you, this is the thing. I think you can judge pretty much everything that you need to know about a lot of people by how they interact with waiters.
Oh, God, yes. It's interesting that you mentioned that, because one of my tips for guys, if you're dating them, or girls, I guess, is if you go out to eat with them and they treat the waitstaff like shit, or they're very demanding, then it's just like a no-go. Like, no.
Yeah, I just, you know...
Anybody who treats waiters like shit and does not even say thank you when they bring them a water, then, you know, fuck you. Get out the door.
Yeah, it's a test that everyone should be able to pass, and that fortunately for those of us who are looking to cull certain people from our experience, not everyone does pass. You know?
I mean, in my line of business, which is retail customer service, you can tell the people who have worked retail or customer service before. Like, now they may be lawyers, they may be doing this, they may be doing that. But the fact that they clean up after themselves in a store, or at least try to, especially when it relates to their children, like if their children are making a mess, they will strive to clean it up. You know that they have worked retail before.
It may not even be retail. I think it's, but I think you're onto something. I think it's because of the way that our economy is, which is, you know, a good thing that we have a lot of sort of white collar indirect service jobs, you know, people who are, you know, accountants or clerks or all the things that I don't understand what they do. We have a lot of people who, in the course of their professional careers or education, don't have to either interact with customers or be responsible for their physical environment. And you see that in the way that they interact with people and their physical environment. Don't you think?
Yes. Again, I'm trying to stifling it down.
I can understand. So anyhow, yeah, speaking of which, we were mentioning thrift shops, and you have a chip on your shoulder about good man Macklemore. What on earth could you have against Macklemore, a broad-minded fella? Well, hold on. We'll get to that in a second. So, by the way, this is what I know about Macklemore. I know the thrift shop song. I know that the song about the gay people, about he keeps me warm, and I know that he looks like Biff Tannen, and that's 100% of what I know about Macklemore.
You're forgetting the fact that he was his music, the beat for Can't Hold Us, was used in the Microsoft ads that you love so much.
Oh God, the ones with like people dancing for no damn reason because they like their stupid Windows 8 tablet?
No, the one that was showcasing the fact that you can delete emails now.
Yeah, what's with that? Is it like 1994? Hey... Come get Outlook because you can delete email?
It's been proved for a while now, I think, that Windows advertising needs a rehaul. It's a total overdue.
Yeah, that's old hat. Microsoft advertising is awful. So what's your beef with Macklemore?
My beef with Macklemore is just that he's not a very good rapper at all. And, I guess, good for him, he tapped into America's love of thrift shops.
Here's my question about Macklemore. I think you're hitting on something, which is, and I am old. And I don't understand how
I'm his target demographic, and I still think he's awful.
Well, you know, immaterial whether or not he's awful, because I am not. I liked hip hop back in the day, as the kids say. But you know, I'm not that much up on it now. But I don't understand how he's not Vanilla Ice. To me, he just seems like, you know, like middle brow white kid appropriating a rap culture. Now, it may be from a sincere enthusiasm and love for it, but when I watch him do stuff, it's like I cringe. It looks absurd.
It's not even watching, it's listening. I have listened to a lot more of his music than I think you have, and he's just sloppy. I'm like, this is just it's like me with Christina Aguilera. I just don't like it because it's just bad. Like, I have no other way to describe it. But
by the way, this is not to say that white folks don't get to rap, because I think Eminem does a magnificent job. I think, you know, I love Elvis Presley. I love a lot of Blue-Eyed Soul. So it's not that I don't think that good can come from white people's horrible appropriation of minority culture, as imperialistic as it is. Because, you know, that's sort of how the world works. I just don't get, because he seems singularly without irony toward his station. Am I wrong about that?
But no, it's weird. It's like he's a hipster rapper, so.
Right, like he's an MC that's listened to by a lot of people who don't listen to other rap.
Maybe. I don't know. Honestly, his existence is kind of it just baffles me.
You know what? Get used to that. You're going to feel like that about everything in 10 years.
Well, he was on Colbert. We watched that episode together.
Right.
He did a live performance of Same Love. And the whole time, I'm just sitting there watching him being like, I think I'd heard Thrift Shop like once or twice before. And you know, he's on my TV performing Same Love. And I was like, this is just not good.
Here's what, it isn't good, but.
It reminds me of, it's just like freestyling, like just a bunch of dudes freestyling in, well, people don't.
Here's what it reminds me of. It's not that it's bad, although it's not very good, I guess. I'm not an expert. Who knows? MC my way out of a paper bag.
Here's a question. Who's better, Macklemore or Tupac?
Oh, Tupac by a mile.
There you go.
Well, no, but that's like saying, you know. Here's my point. It's not that he's bad, because I'm a little bit, but not necessarily qualified to judge whether or not he's a good or bad MC. What I find a little bit goofy, like I watch him, here's what I think. When I watch him, it's like watching one of these, you know, in Spinal Tap, this mm-hmm. is Spinal Tap,
mm-hmm.
When they do Listen to the Flower People.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's how I felt when I was watching Macklemore do his gay rights song. It was like, in 20 years, that is going to look so stiltedly earnest and like laughable.
Do you remember the all-star remix of What's Going On by Marvin Gaye in 2001?
I do. There was like Julian Lennon or something did it, right?
No, it was, well, he might have been responsible for it, but it was a bunch of artists at the time.
Right, I think it was one of these, like, scions of a noble family. It was maybe one of the gays,
singing,
I don't know.
You know, What's Going On, including, like, you know, like the Backstreet Boys.
Oh, no, it was. I was thinking of Sean Lennon doing an Imagine supergroup, because I think there was another one around the same time where he did,
this was
like,
after the World
supergroup.
Trade Center, the 9/11 attacks, and they got a bunch of celebrities together to record another version of What's Going On, and it was just terrible.
Right, it's just the earnestness. It's really hard to do something that is earnest and social that doesn't instantly feel sort of cringingly dated.
Yeah.
These songs seem like creatures of their time, you know? Like Pac-Man Fever.
Thrift Shop is a novelty song. Can't Hold Us is one that might be on radio in a couple of years. However, God, any artist who lets themselves be covered by Kidz Bop just automatically goes to shit in my head.
Yeah, okay, so you have to understand that in this household, the way that most new music arrives into the household is through Kate's infectious brainwashing via in-store PA system of the most recent Kidz Bop recording. I had no idea what Kidz Bop was before I was friends with Kate. So explain, Kate, first explain Kidz Bop and then explain why it is insidious.
Kidz Bop is, it's a lot like now.
Am I wrong in assuming there is a Z in Kidz Bop?
No, there is. There is a Z. It's Kidz Bop. It's a lot like now, that's what I call music, in the sense that they take hits of the last 6 months and compile them into one CD.
You know what it is? It's like Mitch Miller. It's Mitch Miller. It's like they've sanitized the popular hits of the day. You have no idea who Mitch Miller is,
no.
Do you?
No.
Continue.
So they take the idea of compiling recent hits, however, they get kids to sing them and make them kid-friendly, which means they basically strip every reference to religion, violence, sex, drugs, anything you could think that you wouldn't want your kid to listen to on popular radio. And then they re-record it with the kids with new lyrics, not all the time new, but mostly there's a couple of instances where things get a little bit hairy. And then they mass market that to children.
Although I can imagine that if there were a song with the line, things got a little bit hairy, Kidz Bop would also cut that out.
I'm trying to think of some particularly egregious examples.
Well, I think the Gungam style one people would understand.
Yes, on Kids Bop 23, Gungam style was...
I love how you know the volume numbers of various Kids Bop recordings.
Gungam style was covered, and they actually... This is a song that is largely sung in Korean, as I'm sure everyone is aware. But they literally went in and rewrote the Korean lyrics to make it kid-friendly.
And in the place where Kate works, let me paint a word picture for you. These recordings are playing Clockwork Orange style all the time until her brain has no choice but to relent and allow them to occupy.
There's a lot of really silly, like, substitutions. They can cover something like Kesha's TikTok, and then they'll cover something like Taylor Swift's 22. It's so strange. I'm trying to think of an example to explain to you, like,
but how about the one where I'm a Kids Bop kid?
So there's a song on the latest Kids Bop, which is about a breakup for someone who's angry, an angry breakup. And the people sing, there's this one line, it's, "You're from the 70s, but I'm a 90s bitch," is the lyric.
That's in the original.
By
the way, this is two people who are not terribly aware of the source recording to begin with.
I mean, I am. I've had a sidecar in me, so cut me some slack. So there's this lyric, and it's like the chorus is, "I watched you drive your car over the I watched you crash your car into a bridge, I watched it let it burn, I threw your shit down the stairs," all these things like that. And they change it in Kids Bop into like, "I watched you drive your car across the bridge, I watched it turn, I put your stuff into a bag, I threw it down the stairs," on and on and on. And they get to this point where the original lyric is, "You're from the 70s, but I'm a 90s bitch," and they replace it with, "You're from the 70s, but I'm a Kids Bop kid."
And that is just, that just makes it creepier. Because then it's a guy from the 1970s who is into Kids Bop kids. And that, I don't understand why that makes it better unless the rest of the song has been completely denuded and desexualized, which it doesn't sound like it has been.
It's just like, it's still,
right,
for
it's
all
still
reasons.
A song describing the same sort of relationship instead of being between people of 20 years separation or 10 plus years separation.
Yeah.
It's Kids Bop kid and some creepy dude from the 70s. That does not sound
like
that.
Yeah, you're from the 70s. It doesn't make any sense, especially there's,
you know,
a variety of reasons.
Here's what this is. This is, and this is a topic that you and I have talked about many times.
Oh, I was going to bring it back to Macklemore, but you go ahead.
No, I was just saying, this is a topic that you and I have talked about many times, which is, and that you sometimes are incredulous, but when I was a child, things looked like they were going in the right direction in terms of culture and feminism and permissiveness, and we have taken a radical, weird turn somewhere long about the Clinton impeachment, and now everything is screwy and it's becoming the Handmaid's Tale.
I think that you are underestimating how socially aware you were when you were my age, excuse me, when you were young. Because when I was growing up, it was the 90s and things just were.
But you know,
you
seriously.
Don't lie to me, you had no sense of feminism or cultural progress when you were 7 years old.
You're wrong. You're absolutely wrong. When I was a kid, we had Free to Be You and Me on our turntable in vinyl. We had the ERA was being debated. Like, there was a moment in the late 70s and early 80s when it looked like America was going to lead the world in women's rights. And ERA got defeated, and it all went to shit after that. It's all Phyllis Schlafly's fault.
I just feel like you were retroactively determining what was happening, because I think any 7-year-old, any 10-year-old, anybody who is not politically aware will only be able to say, yeah, my parents liked that Clinton guy.
Well, okay, so... You may be a little right. I may have been a little bit more aware, but I honestly have talked to enough people who are my age that... There really is a change in the sort of sexual and moral culture that kids grow up in. Now, there's some stuff that's good. I grew up in the age of AIDS when I was a teenager, which meant sex was going to kill you. But I also grew up...
It still will, by the way.
I also grew up when I was a child in an age where we were really pushing to make women equal partners to men in the world. And there weren't a lot of countervailing forces that were open and public about wanting to subordinate women. And we are in a different place right now. One of my favorite things about my wife is that she didn't take my damn name. My mom is special. I love my... I hang out with my mom today. You like my mom?
I do. She's very cute and very cute and sweet and considerate and honestly, I'm trying to figure out how she gave birth to you, but...
Here's the thing with my mom. And this is a trait that we may share, is that my mom has trouble pinning down something conclusive when you ask her a question, and it becomes very maddening.
Well, that is actually very true, especially if you feel like you're inconveniencing someone else.
Right. So, hey, let's do a little roleplay. Okay, so this is my mom today. I had to get my mom and take her to work today, and I needed to know what time I was going to pick her up from work. So I'll be my mom, and you be me.
Okay.
And the important fact is that, like me, you do not care what time it is that you actually have to pick her up from work. Okay?
Okay.
So let's and scene.
Hey mom, what time do I have to pick you up today?
Oh, I don't know. What's good for you?
Why is your mom from Canada all of a sudden?
She's from Minnesota. Every time we talk about my mom, she's from Minnesota.
Okay, so sorry.
So start it over.
Mom, what time do I have to pick you up today? Just let me know.
Oh, I don't know. What's good for you?
Well, Mom, I don't have anything to do. Just let me know when you want to be picked up. I mean, my schedule's revolving around you.
Right, but when would be good for you?
In any time works. I really have nothing to do between the hours of 4 and 9.
Well, anything's fine for me.
No, but when do you need to leave?
Well, I could do 5:30. I could do 6. I could do 6:30. I could do 7. I could do 7:30.
Okay, well, what time do you actually want to leave? I will come pick you up whenever.
It really does not make any difference to me what is good for you.
No, but Mom, you're at work. You clearly want to leave. Just tell me the soonest you can be out of there, and I'm there.
I want you to be comfortable with when you pick me up.
Okay, how about 5:30?
Well, that's fine. Seriously,
also,
that's what it's like.
I just want to make a point to everyone listening. Josh's mom does not actually talk like that.
No, my mom is not in any way from Minnesota. But in my mind, my mother and Marge Gunderson from Fargo are the same person.
Okay.
My point being, my mother, God love her, she is, and you will testify to this, among the most beloved people in my life, if not the most beloved people. But God love her, if you ask her a question and you are indifferent about the response, she will make you different about the response. And that is all that I am saying. It can sometimes be frustrating. Is your mom have any personality tics like that?
My mother is a very special person, and I don't really feel like we have the time or the listener's attention to go into that.
Okay, fair enough. Hey, before we go, let's do our recommendations for the week. You want to go first? Or you want me to go first?
You go first.
Okay, so building on what Kate said from earlier in the show, in reference to J.J. Abrams, who is a esteemed television producer, movie director, movie producer, television producer, etc.
Mm-hmm.
A man of all tricks. But in his youth, was on occasion also an actor. And the movie that I am going to recommend, is a movie in which he gave a performance that my wife and I enjoyed and quote to this day. And that movie is 6 Degrees of Separation. It's the movie version, the Fred Skepsi directed version of the John Guare play, starring Will Smith and Stockard Channing and Donald Sutherland. But J.J. Abrams has a minor role in it, and it is wonderful. It fits in with my, as you know, love of all things fraud. Mm. It is a story of a based on a true story of a young African-American man who, through guile and cleverness, worked his way into the households of some of the Upper East Side's most illustrious families and spent evenings with them and had meals with them, but apparently did not defraud them in any way. And the young man is played by Will Smith in what I still believe to be his finest performance, and Stockard Channing in what I consider to be her finest performance, and it is a wonderful movie, and I highly recommend it. Okay, go for it.
On the lines of things that nerds enjoy in terms of source material and nerdy things, I'm going to go ahead and recommend the original Planet of the Apes novel by Pierre Boulle. Not
Ooh,
a lot of
nice.
People know that Planet of the Apes, the movie, was based on a novel by a French novelist. It's a lot different from the movie, so don't expect to...
So no No, get your dirty paws off me.
No, the apes are actually very technologically advanced in the novel, but it is still... Anybody who loves the series or wants to journey into some random sci-fi would find themselves well-versed to look into Pierre Boulle's Planet of the Apes.
So there we go. There are our recommendations for the week. The movie of 6 Degrees of Separation and the original novel of Planet of the Apes by Pierre Boulle. That's all for this week's edition of Prefer Not To. Hey, how did you like the sidecar?
I like it a lot, honestly.
Wow, I just got some sidecar on my shoulder. That was bracing.
It is a lovely cocktail.
I agree. So thank you to listener Sarah.
Thank you, Sarah.
Who recommended the sidecar. And I am Josh.
I am Kate.
And we look forward to spending another cocktail hour with you sometime soon. Thanks a bunch.
Thanks for listening.